Good morning, friends. My name's Mark, if we haven't met before. Please keep that passage open in front of you, and I trust you have an outline to assist you through this passage. My question to start us today is, do you know much about wrestling? As I understand it, there are two ways to wrestle. You see, The Rock is the loving champion of the people's nation, the nation of domination. He made the people's elbow. Bev, can you come up and I'll demonstrate the people's elbow? And he made us to be people's champion under him in our living rooms and on the bed and on the couch. But is that the way it is now? We all reject the people's champion, The Rock, trying to Greco-Roman wrestle instead. However, we fail to take down our opponents with a toss, to make a reversal out of a defensive position, execute a headlock, or pin them for the win. What will The Rock do about this rebellion? I actually have no idea. In our Old Testament passage today, the Old Testament patriarch Jacob steps into the ring for a one-on-one, no-holds-bar WrestleMania title fight. Firstly, the wrestler's backstory. Every serious wrestler has risen to fame through a life of hardship. Do you remember Jacob's rise to fame? He wrestled with his brother in Rachel's womb, even grasping onto Esau's ankle in a reverse clover leaf as he was born. Consequently, his name means Jacob, which means take the hill or the deceiver. And I think that would make a great rock and roll wrestler's name, the deceiver. And now before the bout, some marketer thought it would be a smart idea to allow wrestlers to take a microphone and try and take down their opponents with smack talk. The Rock says, "Can you smell what The Rock is cooking?" amongst many other things. You can see Jacob's catchphrase in verse 26 of this passage. "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Like his birth, Jacob is characterised by grasping at other people's blessings. Jacob's wrestled with Esau as a young man, buying his birthright with a bowl of red stuff. Eventually, he wrestled with his parents as well, deceiving Isaac into giving him Esau's blessing. And interestingly, by the end of chapter 7, Esau is done with the wrestling. He just wants to kill Jacob. So Jacob flees and spends 20 years with his uncle Laban. And of course, the two of them wrestled together. Laban tricks Jacob into marrying Leah before Rachel. Then Leah tries to trick Jacob into loving her, and Rachel also tries to obtain a blessing of children from him. They use their slaves as pawns in a tag team wrestling match with Jacob in a game of deception. And when Rachel's slave Bilhah gives her a son for Jacob, she says, "In my wrestlings with God, I have wrestled with my sister and won." And she named him Naphtali. Naphtali means my wrestlings. Jacob even tricks Laban into using his livestock in a miraculous breeding program to make himself prosperous. Jacob's life is one big wrestling match. He is constantly trying to take something good, a blessing, from other people. He constantly seeks these blessings by means of deception. I will not let you go unless you bless me. That's Jacob's life motto. That's his catchphrase. Now, alongside the story of Isaac and his sons, we have also been observing God fulfilling his promises. Isaac's family is extremely dysfunctional, but God has been prospering them, blessing them, protecting them, helping them persevere. And over 20 years that Jacob has been with Laban, he's slowly come to trust God's promises himself. It's been a very slow process of growing in spiritual maturity. So when God personally instructs Jacob to return to the promised land, Jacob acts in obedience. You see that if you just look back in Genesis chapter 31, the previous chapter in verse 3, we read, Yahweh said to him, go back to the land of your fathers, to your family, and I will be with you. And in verse 13, Jacob talks with Leah and Rachel about this and says he must go in obedience to God. In verse 42, he tells Laban how God has been involved in his entire life. Have a look at that one. Verse 42 of 31. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been with me, certainly now you would have sent me off empty-handed. But God has seen my affliction and my hard work, and he issued his verdict last night. Jacob recognizes that God is in control, and he isn't. Jacob acknowledges that God has been treating him in a manner that he doesn't deserve, bringing him prosperity and growing his family. And so when God instructs Jacob to return to Canaan, he goes. However, as we begin verse 32, there is a huge obstacle that meets Jacob as he goes back to the land. His twin brother Esau. Jacob will be going back to Canaan in faith. However, he must face his brother who wants him dead. And this is tense stuff. Is it possible for completely estranged brothers to reconcile? Or will Esau finish Jacob off? From the outset, once again, we see that God is involved in these affairs. He is confirming his promises to Jacob. So Jacob has been camping in a place called Gilead, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan River in the hill country. And he sets off west towards Canaan. He just got to cross over the Jordan River. And bam! Chapter 2, verse 31, bam, an army of angels is there. Now, I don't know if you guys go camping much. I enjoyed camping as a kid and sometimes get to go away on a weekend, but we often leave at night, so we don't get to wherever we're camping, and we set up in the dark, and there's this experience in a Monday, on the morning, not a Monday, I don't get camping on a Monday, wouldn't that be a blessing? Where you step out of your tent the first morning and you survey all that's around, a creek running beside the campsite, cliff faces up in the mountains, frost on the ground, whatever it might be. Jacob has one of those moments. He set up his camp in the middle of God's army. Mahanaim is an appropriate name. Two camps, they're there, two camps together. But does Jacob get the point? Remember God's promise to him, chapter 31, verse 3, I will be with you. God and his army of angels are there, ready to back him up. Let's see if Jacob understands the significance of this spiritual reality. So in verse 3, Jacob sends messengers off to Esau with a very diplomatic message. He seeks favor from Esau. Just note, you see in these verses, he refers to Esau as my lord and himself as my servant. A little bit deceptive, I think, but it's diplomatic. And then the messengers return. The news doesn't appear favourable. Verse 6, When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau. He is coming to meet you. He has 400 men with him." Esau has his own army. Is this good or bad? Actually, the question is whether Jacob will trust God in this time of stress. 20 years ago at Bethel, when Jacob was leaving, God promised to Jacob to bring him back. He would fulfill his promises. Now as he approaches the land again, Jacob is in the midst of God's army, and Esau and his men are approaching too. Can he rely on God? Well, the immediate answer, we think, is no. We see Jacob's response in verse 7, fear. This fear brings out the worst in Jacob. He's back to his deceitful ways, dividing up his family in order to escape the expected attack from Esau. Verse 8, he thought, if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, the remaining one can escape. It appears a wise strategy. Only half of the family will get wiped out. But it does not reflect a reliance on God's promised unfailing care. Well, Jacob's no spiritual baby, though. This fear drives him to prayer, and it's a great prayer. Have a look at Jacob's prayer in verses 9 to 12. And Jacob said, "God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Yahweh who said to me, 'Go back to your land and your family, and I will cause you to prosper,' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. Indeed, I crossed over the Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two camps. Please rescue me from my brother Esau, for I am afraid of him. Otherwise, he may come and attack me, the mothers and their children. You have said, 'I will cause you to prosper, and I will make your offspring like the sand of the sea, too numerous to be counted.'" In the face of annihilation, Jacob acknowledges God's promises, yet how much he is and also how unworthy he is to receive God's grace. He asks to be delivered from Esau, admitting his fears. His only hope is that God will remain faithful to his promises, that through his family they will become a great nation. That, friends, is a sinner's prayer. It's a confession that he has tried to live his life his own way without God. He acknowledges he is unworthy of God. He confesses that he cannot fathom how God might save him, only knows that God is faithful and will. The question now is whether Jacob has finished wrestling. Can he admit in practice, in his life, that God is the one in control? Can he tap out and submit to God being in full control? Well, in verses 13 to 20, Jacob prepares a gift for his brother. It almost seems as if he's trying to buy forgiveness, because you see in verse 20, he uses the language of sacrifice, turning away Esau's anger, trying to appease him. Unless Esau's anger is dealt with, there can be no forgiveness. Well, that night, verse 21, the gift is sent ahead in that series of groups that go on before. Jacob's wife, and his sons are sent on over the Jordan River, and so Jacob remains, standing alone on the edge of the Jordan River at the ford of Jabbok. Which actually, to change metaphors, I think that's a great Star Wars name, the Ford of Jabbok. You know, you sort of see that in one of their movies. Anyway, the tension is mounting. Will Esau allow Jacob to live? Will the deceiver be allowed to enter into the promised land? And really, to answer that question, we do watch one of the strangest wrestling matches ever. In the one, I'd need the mic to descend from the roof so I can call this. In one corner is the strong man Jacob, standing alone. He is known to have lifted huge stones off the tops of worlds, something that would take several shepherds to do, chapter 29. In the other corner, an unknown man. Who is this man? No details are given to us. He is an unknown factor in this bout. The bout is unlimited rounds, ending at either dawn or if one of the competitors is pinned, taken out. Ding, ding, game on. Jacob and this man wrestle until daybreak. And Jacob's no pushover when it comes to wrestling. He's metaphorically, as we've seen, spent his whole life doing it. However, the other man has an unexpected move. He knows how to completely disable the strong man. His move is called the divine touch. Our translations, you see in verse 25, is struck. But the verb here has this sense of vapour, as in the slightest of touches. And so it is with the slightest of touches, Jacob's hip, the strength of a wrestler, is dislocated. It's an awesome move. It's a move that only the divine maker could really pull off. Is this God in disguise? Well, it's the close of the match. Jacob can do nothing but cling to this man. His hip's dislocated, but again, Jacob has that lifetime of experience of grasping at other people's heels, and so this time he holds on. And the man tells Jacob to submit. Verse 26, let me go, for it's daybreak. Jacob yells out his catchphrase. Can you smell what the rock is cooking? Verse 26, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Even as Jacob faces defeat, he is still desperate for a blessing. And the question we ask ourselves at this point is whether Jacob deserves mercy. Every blessing that Jacob has secured throughout his life has come through some form of deceit. Should this man bless Jacob, even though he has him in a chokehold and he's about to win? We might all give Jacob's the thumb down. We might say it's unfair, it's unjust for Jacob to have prospered and been protected by God. Esau, for example, has every right to stand on the edge and yell down abuse at Jacob as he's wrestling because he's stolen his blessings. However, in his great mercy, the man does not treat him as he deserves. He doesn't deserve a blessing, but that is what the man will give him. Actually, it's only a blessing that God can give. It's the blessing of transformation, a name change. Have a look at it, verse 27. What is your name, the man asked. Jacob, he replied. Your name will no longer be Jacob, he said. It will be Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men, and have prevailed. It turns out that Jacob has been wrestling with God, not just overnight, and it's not just with people. Through his entire life, he's been struggling against God. But God has always shown Jacob grace, blessing him, protecting him, prospering him. Jacob's been trying to run his life his own way without God. That now must end. The deceiver cannot inherit God's promises or God's land. He must be transformed by God before he enters into God's rest. So his new name no longer reflects his failings, rather it reflects God's grace. Jacob means deceiver. Israel sounds like God strives or God prevails. The prophet Hosea helps us understand what we're really seeing in this event. So Hosea 12 says, in the womb he grasped his brother's heel, As an adult, he wrestled with God. Jacob struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favour. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with him. Jacob knows he has wrestled with God. In reflection, he changes the name of this place where he is from Mahanaim, which means two camps, which actually I think is a reflection of his stupid plan to try and deceive Esau by dividing up his family. He changes the name to Penuel because, verse 30, "For I have seen God face to face," he said, "yet my life has been spared." God did not treat Jacob as he deserved. God has shown Jacob grace, sparing his life, transforming him by giving him a new name that reflects God's mercy. And so in verse 31, he enters the promised land limping. He can't hide the scar of a lifetime of deceit. However, that weakness is also a symbol of his transformation. So what will happen when Jacob meets Esau? Will Israel's gift, Jacob's gift, be sufficient to appease Esau? Will Esau forgive him? Well, initially, it doesn't look good. Have a look at chapter 33, verse 1. "Now Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming toward him with 400 men." There's a reality of a lifetime of deception approaching. Esau and his army. And in verses 1 to 3, Jacob quickly moves back to protecting himself with his two camps tactic. But then the unexpected happens. Verse 4, "But Esau ran to meet him, hugged him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Then they wept. When Esau looked up and saw the women and the children, he asked, 'Who are these with you?' He answered, 'The children God has graciously given your servant.' Then the slaves and their children approached him and bowed down. Leah and her children also approached and bowed down. And then Joseph and Rachel approached and bowed down." Not only Jacob, but his whole family is reconciled to Esau. Again, Jacob is treated with unexpected and undeserved mercy, undeserved grace. Why? Why does Esau not wipe him out as he was planning? Well, in changing the language from "my lord and my servant" in verse 9, Esau replies, "I have enough, my brother." God has blessed Esau, even though he had despised his own birthright. So at that point, reconciled brothers come together and they start to wrestle. They try to wrestle to outdo one another, showing grace. Verses 10 and 11. "But Jacob said, 'No, please, if I have found favour or grace with you, take this gift, this grace, from me. For instead I have seen your face and it is like seeing God's face. Since you have accepted me, please take my present, grace, that was brought to you because God has been gracious to me and I have everything I need.' So Jacob urged him until he accepted." Jacob's response to receiving God's grace was to be generous himself. He tries to outdo Esau with undeserved grace. The chapter essentially finishes, though, with Jacob returning to his old ways. It seems the old deceptive ways continue to resurface. Nevertheless, Israel, is back in the promised land, having been transformed by God into this new man, Israel. Verse 20, "And he," Israel, "set up an altar there and called it God, the God of Israel." Israel's back in the land and worshipping their God, living in the land as God desires. Well, the message of these two chapters is certainly that of God's grace to Jacob. By God's grace, Jacob is transformed into Israel. By God's grace, Israel is gracious. The son of the promise is welcomed back into the land with a blessing, and we're starting to see the beginning of the nation. The 11 sons are back in the land, they've got a great name now, Israel, meaning God strives, and they're experiencing God's providential care. Of course, Jacob's story is no different to our own. Our own experience in this world. We all live our lives here rejecting the rule of God, trying to live our lives our own way without him. We deserve God's judgment, death. We deserve the life that God has graciously given us to be taken away. However, because of his love, God does not treat us as we deserve. He sent his son into the world, the man Jesus Christ, descendant of Israel, descendant of Judah. Jesus always lived under God's rule. And by dying in him, in our place, taking the divine touch of death on our behalf, he took our punishment and brought forgiveness. God shows us grace through Jesus. There are some fabulous verses in Romans 5 which speak of God's undeserved favour to us as sinners. Remember these, Romans 5, 6, "For while we were still helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly." Verse 8, "God proves his own love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." We deserve God's wrath, however he declares us righteous, not guilty, and consequently no charge of sin will stick against us. We might have been enemies in mortal combat with God, but through Jesus' death and resurrection, we can be forgiven. And we need to pray like Jacob, acknowledging our complete dependence on God's grace and mercy, confessing our reliance upon his ability to prevail, not our own, so that we might be reconciled to God. When we understand and know God's grace to us, we are compelled, like Jacob and Esau, to show grace to others. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, "For the love of Christ compels us, since we have reached this conclusion, if one died for all, then all have died. And he died for all so that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for the one who has died for them and was raised." Knowing that we've been reconciled to God by his grace compels us to love others, to show unexpected grace and favour to others. In this instance, Paul is talking about how he is compelled by the love of Christ to persuade others to be reconciled to God. That's a one great example of how we can treat others in a way that they don't deserve, calling them to be reconciled with their Creator. Let me just conclude in prayer. Our Father of all life, we thank you for your grace to us in Jesus Christ. We acknowledge that we do not deserve to be forgiven of our rebellion against you, but you treat us as we don't deserve, forgiving us, ignoring our sin, making us righteous. Please help us to recognize how unworthy we are and how great your graciousness towards us is. Father, we just ask that you will compel us through a love and a knowledge of the death and resurrection of your Son to treat others as they don't deserve. Help us to show love in acts of kindness. Help us to proclaim the name of your Son, trying to persuade others to be reconciled to you. We thank you for your unfailing love and grace to us in Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.